Chapter 18 of The Empress Plushilia, 1. Yet other opportunities of improvement lay within the emperor's reach, for his wife used constantly to put him in mind of the divine laws, in which she had first carefully educated herself. In no way exalted by her imperial rank, she was rather fired by it with greater longing for divine things. The greatness of the good gift given her made her love for him, who gave it all the greater, so she bestowed every kind of attention on the maimed and the mutilated, declining all aid from her household and her guards, herself visiting the houses where the sufferers lodged, and providing everyone with what he required. She also went about the guest chambers of the churches, and ministered to the wants of the sick, herself handling pots and pans, and tasting broth, now bringing in a dish, and breaking bread, and offering morsels, and washing out a cup, and going through all the other duties which are supposed to be proper to servants and maids. To them who strove to restrain her from doing these things with her own hands, she would say, "It befits a sovereign to distribute gold. I, for the sovereign power that has been given me, am giving my own service to the giver." To her husband, too, she was ever wont to say, "Husband, you ought always to bethink you what you were once, and what you have become now. By keeping this constantly in mind, you will never grow ungrateful to your benefactor, but will guide in accordance with law the empire bestowed upon you, and thus you will worship him who gave it." By ever using language of this kind, she with fair and wholesome care, as it were, watered the seeds of virtue planted in her husband's heart. She died before her husband, and not long after the time of her death events occurred which showed how well her husband loved her. Chapter 19 of The Sedition of Antioch, 1. In consequence of his continual wars, the emperor was compelled to impose heavy taxes on the cities of the empire, too. The city of Antioch refused to put up with a new tax, and when the people saw the victims of its exaction subjected to torture and indignity, then, in addition to the usual deeds which a mob is wont to do when it is seizing an opportunity for disorder, they pulled down the bronze statue of the illustrious Plushilla, for so was the empress named, and dragged it over a great part of the town. 3. On being informed of these events, the emperor, as was to be expected, was indignant. He then deprived the city of her privileges, and gave her dignity to her neighbor, with the idea that thus he could inflict on her the greatest indignity, for Antioch, from the earliest times, bad had a rival in Laodicea. 4. He further threatened to burn and destroy the town, and reduce it to the rank of a village. The magistrates, however, had arrested some men in the very act, and had put them to death, before the tragedy came to the emperor's ears. All these orders had been given by the emperor, but had not been carried out because of the restriction imposed by the edict which had been made by the advice of the great Ambrosius. 5. On the arrival of the commissioners who brought the emperor's threats, Alepicus, then a military commander, and Caesarius, prefect of the palace, styled by the Romans Magister Officiorum, 1. The whole population shuddered in consternation, but the athletes of virtue, 2. Dwelling at the foot of the hill, of whom at that time there were many of the best, made many supplications and entreaties to the imperial officers. The most holy Macedonius, who was quite unversed in the things of this life, and altogether ignorant of the sacred oracles, living on the tops of the mountains, and night and day offering up pure prayers to the Savior of all, was not in the least dismayed at the imperial violence, nor at all affected by the power of the commissioners. As they rode into the middle of the town, he caught hold of one of them by the cloak, and bade both of them dismount. At the sight of a little old man, clad in common rags, they were at first indignant, but some of those who were conducting them informed them of the high character of Macedonius, and then they sprang from their horses, caught hold of his knees, and asked his pardon. The old man, urged on by divine wisdom, spoke to them in the following terms: "Say, dear sirs, to the emperor, you are not only an emperor, you are also a man. Bethink you, therefore, not only of your sovereignty, but also of your nature. You are a man, and you reign over your fellow men. Now the nature of man is formed after the image and likeness of God. Do not, therefore, thus savagely and cruelly order the massacre of God's image, for by punishing his image you will anger the Maker." Think how you are acting thus in your wrath for the sake of a brazen image. Now all who are endued with reason know how far a lifeless image is inferior to one alive and gifted with soul and sense. Take into account, too, that for one image of bronze we can easily make many more. Even you yourself cannot make one single hair of the slain. After the good men had heard these words, they reported them to the emperor, and quenched the flame of his rage. Instead of his threats, he wrote a defense, and explained the cause of his anger. It was not right, said he, because I was in error, that indignity should be inflicted after her death on a woman, so worthy of the highest praise. They that were grieved ought to have armed their anger against me. The emperor further added that he was grieved and distressed when he heard that some had been executed by the magistrates. In relating these events, I have had a twofold object. I did not think it right to leave in oblivion the boldness of the illustrious monk, and I wished to point out the advantage of the edict which was put out by the advice of the great Ambrosius. 1. Chapter 20. Of the destruction of the temples all over the empire. Now the right faithful emperor diverted his energies to resisting paganism, and published edicts, in which he ordered the shrines of the idols to be destroyed. Constantine the Great, most worthy of all eulogy, was indeed the first to grace his empire with true religion, and when he saw the world still given over to foolishness, he issued a general prohibition against the offering of sacrifices to the idols. He had not, however, destroyed the temples, though he ordered them to be kept shut. His sons followed in their father's footsteps. Julian restored the false faith, and rekindled the flame of the ancient fraud. On the accession of Jovian, he once more placed an interdict on the worship of idols, and Valentinian the Great governed Europe, with like laws. Valens, however, allowed everyone else to worship any way they would, and to honor their various objects of adoration. Against the champions of the apostolic decrees alone he persisted in waging war. Accordingly, during the whole period of his reign the altar fire was lit, libations and sacrifices were offered to idols, public feasts were celebrated in the forum, and votaries initiated in the orgies of Dionysus ran about in goatskins, mangling hounds in Bacchic frenzy, and generally behaving in such a way as to show the iniquity of their master. When the right faithful Theodosius found all these evils, he pulled them up by the roots, and consigned them to oblivion. 2. Chapter 21. Of Marcellus, Bishop of Optimaea, and the idols' temples destroyed by him. The first of the bishops to put the edict in force, and destroy the shrines in the city committed to his care was Marcellus, trusting rather in God than in the hands of a multitude. The occurrence is remarkable, and I shall proceed to narrate it. On the death of John, Bishop of Optimaea, whom I have already mentioned, the divine Marcellus, fervent in spirit, 1. According to the apostolic law, was appointed in his stead. Now there had arrived at Optimaea the prefect of the East, 2. With two tribunes, and their troops. Fear of the troops kept the people quiet. An attempt was made to destroy the vast and magnificent shrine of Jupiter. But the building was so firm and solid that to break up its closely compacted stone seemed beyond the power of man, for they were huge, and well, and truly laid, and moreover clamped fast with iron and lead. 3. When the divine Marcellus saw that the prefect was afraid to begin the attack, he sent him unto the rest of the towns, while he himself prayed to God, to aid him in the work of destruction. Next morning there came uninvited to the bishop a man, who was no builder, or mason, or artificer of any kind, but only a laborer, who carried stones, and timber on his back. Give me, said he, two workmen's pay, and I promise you I will easily destroy the temple. The holy bishop did as he was asked, and the following was the fellow's contrivance. Round the four sides of the temple went a portico united to it, and on which its upper story rested. 4. The columns were of great bulk, commensurate with the temple, each being 16 cubits in circumference. The quality of the stone was exceptionally hard, and offering great resistance to the mason's tools. In each of these the man made an opening all round, propping up the superstructure with olive timber, before he went on to another. After he had hollowed out three of the columns, he set fire to the timbers. But a black demon appeared, and would not suffer the wood to be consumed, as it naturally would be, by the fire, and stayed the force of the flame, after the attempt had been made several times, and the plan was proved ineffectual. News of the failure was brought to the bishop, who was taking his noontide sleep. Marcellus forthwith hurried to the church, ordered water to be poured into a pail, and placed the water upon the divine altar. Then, bending his head to the ground, he besought the loving Lord, in no way to give unto the usurped power of the demon, but to lay bare its weakness, and exhibit his own strength, lest unbelievers should henceforth find excuse for greater wrong. With these and other like words he made the sign of the cross over the water, and ordered Equitius, one of his deacons, who was armed with faith and enthusiasm, to take the water, and sprinkle it in faith, and then apply the flame. His orders were obeyed, and the demon, unable to endure the approach of the water, fled. Then the fire, affected by its for the water, as though it had been oil, caught the wood, and consumed it in an instant. When their support had vanished, the columns themselves fell down, and dragged other 12 with them. The side of the temple which was connected with the columns was dragged down by the violence of their fall, and carried away with them. The crash, which was tremendous, was heard throughout the town, and all ran to see the sight. No sooner did the multitude hear of the flight of the hostile demon, than they broke out into a hymn of praise to God. Other shrines were destroyed in like manner by this holy bishop, though I have many other most admirable doings of this holy man to relate, for he wrote letters to the victorious martyrs, and received replies from them, and himself won the martyr's crown. For the present I hesitate to narrate them, lest by overprolixity I weary the patience of those into whose hands my history may fall. I will therefore now pass to another subject. Chapter 22, of Theophilus, Bishop of Alexandria, and what happened at the demolition of the idols in that city. The illustrious Athanasius was succeeded by the admirable Petrus, Petrus by Timotheus, and Timotheus by Theophilus, a man of sound wisdom, and of a lofty courage. 1. By him Alexandria was set free from the error of idolatry. 4. Not content with razing the idols' temples to the ground, he exposed the tricks of the priests to the victims of their wiles. For they had constructed statues of bronze and wood hollow, within, and fastened the backs of them to the temple walls, leaving in these walls certain invisible openings. Then coming up from their secret chambers they got inside the statues, and through them gave any order they liked, and the hearers, tricked and cheated, obeyed. 1. These tricks the wise Theophilus exposed to the people. Moreover he went up into the temple of Serapis, which has been described by some as excelling in size and beauty all the temples in the world, too. There he saw a huge image of which the bulk struck beholders with terror, increased by a lying report which got abroad that if anyone approached it, there would be a great earthquake, and that all the people would be destroyed. The bishop looked on all these tales as the mere driveling of tipsy old women, and in utter derision of the lifeless monster's enormous size, he told a man who had an axe to give Serapis a good blow with it. 3. No sooner had the man struck, than all the folio cried out, for they were afraid of the threatened catastrophe. Serapis, however, who had received the blow, felt no pain, inasmuch as he was made of wood, and uttered never word, since he was a lifeless block. His head was cut off, and forthwith out ran multitudes of mice, for the Egyptian god was a dwelling place for mice. Serapis was broken into small pieces, of which some were committed to the flames, but his head was carried through all the town in sight of his worshippers, who mocked the weakness of him to whom they had bowed the knee. Thus all over the world the shrines of the idols were destroyed. 4. Chapter 23, of Flavianus, Bishop of Antioch, and of the sedition which arose in the Western Church on account of Paulinus. At Antioch the great Meletius had been succeeded by Flavianus, who, together with Diodorus, had undergone great struggles for the salvation of the sheep. Paulinus had indeed desired to receive the bishopric, but he was withstood by the clergy on the ground that it was not right that Meletius, at his death, should be succeeded by one who did not share his opinions, and that to the care of the flock ought to be advanced he who was conspicuous for many toils, and had run the risk of many perils, for the sheep's sake. Thus a lasting hostility arose among the Romans and the Egyptians against the East, and the ill feeling was not even destroyed on the death of Paulinus. After him, when Evagrius had occupied his see, hostility was still shewn to the great Flavianus, notwithstanding the fact that the promotion of Evagrius was a violation of the law of the church, for he had been promoted by Paulinus alone in disregard of many canons. For a dying bishop is not permitted to ordain another to take his place, and all the bishops of a province are ordered to be convened. Again, no ordination of a bishop is permitted to take place without three bishops. Nevertheless, they refused to take cognizance of any of these laws, embraced the communion of Evagrius, and filled the ears of the emperor with complaints against Flavianus, so that, being frequently importuned, he summoned him to Constantinople, and ordered him to repair to Rome. Flavianus, however, urged in reply that it was now winter, and promised to obey the command in spring. He then returned home. But when the bishops of Rome, not only the admirable Damasus, but also Syricius his successor and Anastasius the successor of Syricitus, importuned the emperor more vehemently, and represented that, while he put down the rivals against his own authority, he suffered bold rebels against the laws of Christ to maintain their usurped authority, then he sent for him again, and tried to force him to undertake the journey to Rome. On this Flavianus in his great wisdom spoke very boldly, and said, "If, sir, there are some who accuse me of being unsound in the faith, or of life and conversation unworthy of the priesthood, I will accept my accusers themselves for judges, and will submit to whatever sentence they may give. But if they are contending about see and primacy, I will not contest the point. I will not oppose those who wish to take them. I will give way, and resign my bishopric. So, sir, give the episcopal throne of Antioch to whom you will." The emperor admired his manliness and wisdom, and bade him go home again, and tend the church committed to his care. After a considerable time had elapsed, the emperor arrived at Rome, and once more encountered the charges advanced by the bishops on the ground that he was making no attempt to put down the tyranny of Flavianus. The emperor ordered them to set forth the nature of the tyranny, saying that he himself was Flavianus, and had become his protector. The bishops rejoined that it was impossible for them to dispute with the emperor. He then exhorted them in future to join the churches in concord, put an end to the quarrel, and quench the fires of an useless controversy. Paulinus, he pointed out, had long since departed this life. Evagrius had been irregularly promoted. The eastern churches accepted Flavianus as their bishop. Not only the East but all Asia, Pontus, and Thrace were united in communion with him, and all Illyricum recognized his authority over the Oriental bishops. In submission to these councils, the Western bishops promised to bring their hostility to a close, and to receive the envoys, who should he send them. When Flavianus had been informed of this decision, he dispatched to Rome certain worthy bishops with presbyters and deacons of Antioch, giving the chief authority among them to Acacius, bishop of Burma, who was famous throughout the world. On the arrival of Acacius and his party at Rome, they put an end to the protracted quarrel, and after a war of 17 years, one, gave peace to the churches. When the Egyptians were informed of the reconciliation, they too gave up their opposition, and gladly accepted the agreement which was made. At that time Anastasius had been succeeded in the primacy of the Roman Church by Innocent, a man of prudence and ready wit. Theophilus, whom I have previously mentioned, held the see of Alexandria, too,